Daniel Levitin has an unusual history for a neuroscientist. He used to be a well-known session musician, engineer, and record producer. Now, he runs the Laboratory for Music Perception and Expertise at McGill University. And by using advanced brain imaging technology, he's brought his two passions together, to study the way we listen to and make music. Levitin came to our studio to talk with Enstrange Champs.
One of the things that you've done that's so interesting is you've looked at how the brain hears and responds to music, and then you have looked at the ways in which composers and performers have played around with music as a result. And you brought a bunch of examples for us. I wondered if we could talk about some of those.
Sure. You know, one of the things that's so special about it is that almost all music has this sense of momentum. It's going somewhere, but it's going somewhere at a regular pace. Music has this beat, and in most music that we listen to, across genres, classical, hip-hop, rock, jazz, there's this very strong sense of when the next one's going to happen. Now, composers play around with that a bit. I brought an example of Stevie Wonder playing the drums. Many people don't know this, but he's a fantastic drummer, and he plays drums on most of his records.
Huh.
And in this little cut I brought from Superstition, any other drummer, I think, to set this up would basically go or maybe if they were more elaborate, they'd give you a kind of repetition of the hit, and you'd know exactly when something's going to happen, and you'd be able to predict both when and what. Stevie don't do that. He's playing around, and through the whole song, every time he goes through this pattern, he plays something slightly different. He hits the cymbals a little bit harder or a little bit softer. He adds extra beats. He takes a few beats away. It's sort of a game that he's playing with you, and you're both in on it. He's drawing you into this kind of musical game or puzzle of, what do you think I'm going to do next? Well, maybe I'll do it, maybe I won't.
What is it that makes music pleasurable? This seems like an obvious question, I guess, because we all think music is pleasurable, but why? I mean, when Stevie Wonder plays the drums that way, why is it we like it?
We now know, and it's pretty exciting, that there are pleasure centers in the brain, that when you have any pleasurable activity, these things become involved, and the neurons start firing, and they choreograph a kind of neurochemical release and uptake that allows dopamine to be squirted out through the brain. Dopamine is the feel-good neurotransmitter. Other neurons start firing that kind of stimulate your motor cortex and get you that tingly feeling.
So you want to dance?
Yeah, maybe. And it turns out that if you eat chocolate or if you win a bunch of money or you have an orgasm, these neural circuits come online, these pleasure centers, and they're the same ones that come online when you listen to music you like.
Now, related to this, I wanted to ask you about groove, which you wouldn't think of as a technical scientific term, but you have a whole kind of chapter, a section of a chapter in there about what you call groove. What is it?
Really, I'm using it to say something that makes you want to get up and dance or tap your foot or tap the foot in your mind. What's going on in your brain is that your cerebellum is trying to track the regularity of events in the world all the time. It's synchronizing, and in part of the synchronization, it's trying to figure out what's going to happen next and when. And the cerebellum's also connected to your motor cortex, so it sort of induces you to want to tap your finger or snap your finger or clap or move your foot. And I brought another example. I think Superstition has this great quality, but also I think Tell Me Something Good by Rufus has it. One of the reasons it has it is because it's not exactly the same each time. So what that's doing is it's preventing your cerebellum and the rest of your brain from habituating to it. Because the music changes around, it's constantly keeping our brains involved. And what you're hearing on the backbeat is a wah-wah guitar. So you hear the bass go boom, and then you hear a whack, boom, whack, boom, whack, boom, whack. And the whack is this guitar, and it's a little bit different every time, partly because the guitarist is really skilled, but also you're dealing with a human being who's not able to behave or play like a machine.
Another way composers and performers play with expectations has to do with chords, which chords they use. And there's a story you tell about Joni Mitchell and some trouble she had with bass players. I wondered if you could tell that story.
Bass players typically in pop music are playing the root of the chord. The best way to describe it is it's sort of like the anchor point. It's the point that your ear is drawn to.
It's home.
Right. It's the harmonic home. And Joni writes her and invents her own chords and her own voicings, and she doesn't know any music theory. So bass players used to ask her, well, what's the root of that chord? Because they wanted to know what to play. But Joni felt that the music lost something as soon as they did play that note. And uniquely among popular songwriters, she writes ambiguous chords, chords that could be interpreted in two or more different ways. So when she finally met Jaco Pastorius, the late Jaco Pastorius, the bass player from Weather Report, she met a really kindred spirit because he didn't ask her what the root was and he didn't look for it. He danced around the ambiguity, which allowed her music to maintain a more ethereal and I think really a more open-ended quality.
Is that what makes her music, gives it that kind of floating quality?
I think so. It lives in that world of ambiguity. In a sense, it's like a cubist painting, where you might see a face from two different perspectives at once. What the cubists were trying to do there was mimic the brain. The idea that the brain can recognize your face dead on or in profile or from all different angles, but the brain is able to process all these different views sequentially, and the cubists wanted to collapse across the fourth dimension and present at one instant both views of a face. And I think what Joni was trying to do was the musical equivalent, present both views of a musical chord progression. And Jaco allowed her to do that.
I met a friend of spirit. He drank and womanized, and I sat before his sanity. I was holding back from crying.
Daniel Levitin is a neuroscientist at McGill University. He talked with Anne Strangechamps about his book, This Is Your Brain on Music. Coming up, why the two halves of your brain are so different. For to the best of our knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Wiring the Brain, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness. Brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.